It's another episode of the Christian Reef podcast. But are you subscribed? If not, make sure to like, share, and subscribe. Spread the word about the Christian Reef podcast and enjoy this episode. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Christian Reef podcast. Today's guest is a podcaster and Twitch streamer all the way from St. Petersburg in Russia. He goes by the name Angry Ducky. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hello, hello. Yeah, I'm doing well. Nice to be here. Thanks, Chris. Yeah, from St. Petersburg, not Florida, but actual Russia.
It's not just any part of Russia. It's deep Russia.
Oh, no, it's not.
Considering St. Petersburg is considered the cultural city, isn't it, historically?
Yes, it's the cultural capital of all the Russia. It have been for quite a while. First it was built as the capital itself, then it just became the cultural capital.
What are your thoughts about living there? Like, what do you think about St. Petersburg? Because it's always interesting.
Cold. It's cold, it's depressing. I absolutely love it.
Okay. Well, I know how that feels. I lived in a country quite close to Russia called Estonia for about 3 years.
Oh.
And I knew that the winter is different, isn't it? It's hard to explain.
Yes.
Because I don't know, like when I was in Estonia, I remember thinking how it's a different kind of cold. So like it can be like minus 20, but it doesn't necessarily feel like minus 20. But if you're not properly clothed, which sounds like a really obvious thing, but if you're not properly clothed, it can go crazy. Like I remember one time I was on a farm and I was asked to get some like herbs in the snow because they were like covered, but like there were still herbs in the ground.
You were stealing someone's herb on the farm?
No. I was living on a farm and asked to get some herbs from outside, right?
Oh, yeah. Just for legal reasons, you were living on that farm and
everybody knew about it. I would not try and steal fucking herbs in a farm in Estonia or anywhere in Europe because I get shot. Like, why the fuck would you do that? I would not.
That's fair.
No, but I was getting these herbs and I stupidly didn't put any gloves on, right? Because in England, when it's cold, it's like you can get away with like maybe just wearing, you know, ill-equipped, not wearing enough clothes. You can kind of get away with it. You're not gonna really get ill. But when I was living in Estonia, like if I would do that, I would get a cold. But instead of being ill for like a couple of days, I'd be ill for like 3 weeks. You know what I mean? It'd be brutal. And in this particular instance where I went to get these herbs, I grabbed them with my bare hands and came back inside. And my hands were doing that thing where they're so cold that they're burning. And I was just staring at them and putting them in front of the fire and going, oh my God, it hurts so much.
I can understand that. Yeah, Baltic winters are not nearly as mild as England winters. Although here in St. Petersburg, we kind of enjoy the more of a British winter in autumn and in spring. Otherwise, it's either our own kind of winter, which is cold and miserable. And every time you go anywhere, you know, it's not even the cold that gets you. It's usually the fact that there is nothing out there on the street that can be considered warm. Wind is cold.
Yep.
Land you're walking on is cold. Buildings you're walking around, they're cold too. Nothing is warm ever until it's burning, of course.
Because I know like when I was living in Estonia, there was a couple of traditions which I understand are shared between Russia, Finland, Estonia, maybe a few other countries near there, where, you know, for example, if you are coming down with a cold, you keep some sort of like vodka in the freezer and you have like maybe one or two shots, just that. And then that essentially can help you from prevent you from getting a cold or something, or can help.
And that actually helped me several times. It doesn't have to be vodka. It has to be any kind of strong alcohol, Like really, yeah. Any kind of strong alcohol you want, it can be done. And the funniest part was when I used that trick in the trip in Israel. They have all kinds of AC units blowing from everywhere. And of course, I just caught cold a little bit. I was like, nope, I'm not going to the hospital in this country. No way.
Okay.
So I just went into the bar like, can I have a shot of vodka? Thank you very much. Got it, paid for it, went away, and straight went to sleep. Next day, I was like, I have never, ever caught a cold in my entire life.
What was the vodka like in Israel? Like, the reason I asked this, right, just before you give your answer, is that, like, growing up here in the UK, I only ever had access, I think the best vodka you could get was like Russian standard, which is disgusting, right? It's terrible. And then as I got older, there were some others like Absolut Vodka, a few others, which is okay. But mm-hmm. I kind of just assumed that either vodka is terrible or that I just don't like it, right? But when I moved to Estonia, I started trying Russian vodka and Ukrainian vodka. And I don't know. Me personally, I adore Ukrainian vodka. I think it's amazing. And there's a few Russian ones that are pretty good too. But it kind of blew my mind because for the first time in my life, I was genuinely enjoying vodka without a mixer, pure. And it tasted fantastic. I wouldn't feel ill the next day. It just felt great. And what I understood from that, what I was told by the locals as well, is that it's all to do with the quality of the alcohol, which makes sense. The cheaper the alcohol you drink, the worse you feel. So just basically drink high quality alcohol and you'll rarely get sick the next day or whatever. And also, as we were saying before, drinking is part of culture in Europe, but you don't necessarily have the binge drinking culture that we have here in the UK. Like, people will regularly, you know, just sit down, have like, for instance, one of the things that I used to do is you know, you have like the bread, the black bread with the gherkins and the other sandwich fillers, and then you eat like a tiny sandwich as well as the shot of vodka, but always afterwards. And then I understood, I was like, oh, so people don't just drink alcohol straight necessarily. Some people do. Mostly they will eat as they do it, and that makes perfect sense. And that's quite civilized, you know. In other cultures, you know, Italians do the same thing. They have a glass of wine with their pasta or whatever, you know what I mean? It's more civilized. It's nice. But yeah, like, what was, just going back to the question, like, what was it like drinking this this vodka in Israel? Was it good? Was it bad? Like,
no, it wasn't good. It was never good. I actually can remember several times I tried Israeli vodka. Most of the times it was just plain terrible.
Okay. And were there ever...
They don't know how to do that, or they rather import.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's the issue as well, because here in the UK, as I understand, they only ever import the cheap stuff. There are a few vodkas that I've seen that are imported to the UK that do seem to be high quality. I think there's one from like Poland, which is like £100 a bottle or something, which is apparently quite nice. There's a few others, but they seem like that kind of designer vodka, which to me, you know, is not about the taste. You're just paying for a brand, right? Which is just dumb in my opinion. You know, it's all about the, with alcohol, if you're going to drink alcohol, like, you want good quality stuff, you know.
And if you want a really good quality stuff, since you mentioned Ukrainian vodka, they have a very good one because they have a very good crops for that. I kind of have to admit that Russian crops are subpar to Ukrainian crops for making vodka, alcohol at all.
Maybe it's just the selection available in Estonia. I mean, I will say, sorry to my Estonian friends, but Estonian vodka is terrible. It's awful. But interestingly, apparently, historically, Estonia actually used to have the best vodka in the world at one point. But then over the course of many years, and I'm talking like probably maybe 18th, 19th century was when they had like the best vodka in the world. And then problems happen, invasions, blah, blah, blah. And then the quality just drastically deteriorated, right? So then, you know, Russia and
that's
Ukraine.
A possibility.
Yeah, like Russia and Ukraine then became the sort of, I suppose, like the top leaders in terms of producing the best quality stuff. But it's just interesting to me that, like, you can only generally get access to these things by going to that actual country. Like, you can sometimes import stuff, but it's rare. Do you know what I mean? That you can actually like source this stuff. And from what I've seen in many of the stores here in the UK, like you know, Polish shops and Eastern European shops and stuff, is that they will have a lot of the stuff that you can get in Europe, but a lot of the time it will be poor, you know, not so great quality, or you know, like there's a not an extensive selection, which is understandable because it's like the cost of import is so high, you just send what you can, right? And obviously you're probably going to send the cheapest stuff to import because, you know, you got a business to run, like you got to do what's logical from a business perspective. But it means you miss out on so many things, and it's a shame because I don't know, like,
of course
there's so many things that are superior. Like when I tried that vodka for the first time, I was just blown away. I felt like I just missed the trick for so many years, and it just completely changed the way that I look at these things. And it was the same it's not just Europe. I remember going to Scotland, Edinburgh, and trying whiskey for the first time, but like the cask whiskey. And so, like, here's a trick for anyone that doesn't know, right? So if you generally try whiskies and you find yourself disliking them, things like Lafroig and stuff like that, there's a reason. They all taste the same because they all have this weird kind of chemical taste, right? They all taste the same. But when you go to places like Edinburgh and you get these like cask whiskies, which, and the way you can kind of tell that it's this type of whiskey is that it tends to be above a certain percentage. So what I've noticed is it's anything that's above around, I'd say, like 50% or 55% alcohol content is excellent, superb taste. But anything under that, trash, horrible, don't drink it. It's bizarre.
Thank you, by the way, for the advice. I'm kind of more of a whiskey person. And I do want to taste at some point proper cask whiskey.
Well, the reason I bring it up is, it's, for me, that was the same sensation as trying Russian and Ukrainian vodka, like good quality stuff for the first time. It really expanded my mind. And then now I savor for it. Now I'm back in the UK. I'm like, oh, I wish I could get these things. Because it's, you don't even need a lot. That's the great thing about it. It's like, you know, you can put like a bottle of vodka in the freezer, and maybe you
and just treat yourself once in a while.
Yeah, like you don't need much to have that like that. Especially now, like I don't really drink anymore. Special occasions, once in a blue moon, but I don't really drink. Right? Maybe it's because
understandable.
It's like my body violently rejects it. So in one sense, it's a good thing. Like I don't get like a hangover, but I get like extreme fatigue and dehydration, right? Which is normal.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's like the next day I just lose energy. I can't do anything. And I'm like, well, I don't want to feel this way. Like, and it's, again, it's not a hangover, but it's like everything except the sickness. So it's like, oh, well, this sucks. So it makes me rethink every time I drink alcohol. I'm like, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to do this, right? because it's all fun in the moment, but then the next day you just lose it, right?
Yeah.
And obviously when you drink better quality stuff, sometimes you never have that issue. Like every time I used to drink vodka in Estonia, I felt fantastic the next day. But the key was not drinking a lot. That's the key. You only need to maybe polish off one bottle between yourself and someone else, right? So what are we talking about? 500
liters,
right? Plus eating, obviously. That's really important.
Of course. You should never forget the proper eating while you're drinking.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You will have another mind blow effect at some point as well if you ever go to Eastern Europe. Ukrainians have a habit of producing really, really nice moonshine.
Jesus.
It's even better than vodka.
dude, I ain't drinking moonshine. This ain't the Wild West.
No, seriously, it is much better than vodka because they not just make it a vodka taste, they make it taste like various different stuff. It can taste like herbs. It can taste like whiskey even.
You're not selling me moonshine, man. You're not selling
me. No. Ukrainian moonshine, you should at least try once.
Maybe if I got death wish. Jesus.
Maybe if you have a death wish, if Ukrainians offer you a moonshine, you say, no, thank you. When you know you get a death wish.
That's a funny one. I remember I was at a New Year's party one time, right? And this is the power of beautiful women from Europe. So like, we were in the Czech Republic. And it was New Year's, and there was a mixture of Russians, Czech people from Britain. Like, we were university students that had been invited there by friends. So it's a real nice mix of people, right? And I don't know if you've ever been to Prague, Czech Republic, but
yeah,
the women there are amazing. And obviously, there were Russian women there who, again, amazing. And like I said, I'm not a big drinker. I mean, I was my first year at uni, so I was always up for a party, but I knew that it was dangerous partying with Russians. It's always dangerous partying. You'll have the best time ever, don't get me wrong, but
yes,
it's chaos. That's true. And there's this girl who I was, you know, I was trying to get with, you know, and but I wasn't like hooked in it. I just wanted to have a good time. Do you know what I mean? And I was chatting to her. She took an interest in me. We were chatting. It was fun. And she's taking shots with this other girl. And I'm just watching them just in amazement because they're just knocking like back like five at once. Like, they don't give a shit. And they were doing the classic tequila shot thing where you take the shot and I don't know the order, but you put like a line of salt on the...
Yes.
Hand and all that, and then you sniff
some kind of lime.
Yeah,
like I don't know, what do you do with it?
Yeah, but so they were doing that with vodka and tequila, and originally she said, "Oh, you're gonna do a shot," and I was like, "Oh, no, I'm cool." And then she's like, "Really?" But she said it in that way, like, "You're not gonna do it," and I felt like it was a challenge. Like, if I want the woman, I need to do the shots, and I was just like, "I'll do it. I can do it. Us Brits, we drink loads. It's great. No worries. I'm representing England right now." So it's just like, let's go for it. And that was the beginning of the end. From that point onwards, I remember most of the night, but we got very, very drunk. But again, same thing, because of the good quality of the alcohol. The next day, I felt fine. Like, no problems. And we mixed as well, which you should never do. Just drinking advice in general for anyone listening. Never mix your drinks. Never do that. It's stupid. Stick to one type of alcohol and that's it. But obviously, that's easier said than done. And let's be real.
Definitely.
Like,
here it's usually called never down mix.
Yeah, because
no taboo for mixing it, just don't down mix.
The problem is it happens though. Like, I say don't do that, but I'll probably end up doing it again, because what always happens, you sit down at a table or something when you go somewhere, right? You have a couple of drinks, you're chatting, that's how the night begins, and then someone, usually the crazy person, just brings a round of shots in, like, "Hey guys, let's do shots," and you're like, "Oh, well," and he's like, "Well, I've bought them now," and you're like, "Okay, I guess we gotta do one," and then one becomes two, and then two becomes four, and then four becomes 10, and before you know it, you're singing in some European city off your face, blowing fireworks everywhere. Not me, that was someone else. And doing
definitely was someone else,
you know, for real. I had a friend, I'm not gonna name him, but he knows who he is, so he's listening. And literally we were in this group and he's setting off fireworks in different parts of Prague, right? But he'd run away from us, go down an alleyway and do it. But I don't know what it was with that city, Prague, but like every time he would set off a firework, they weren't even big, they were like those tiny ones. But there was this one particular firework that he set off, and I swear to God, it sounded like a nuclear bomb or something had gone off. It was like, boom! And we were like, holy shit! I was like, dude, you gotta stop doing that. We're gonna get like caught by the police at this rate. Like, this is dodgy. But yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, Prague is a very fun town. I had a lot of fun there myself when I was there, mostly because I really enjoyed the beer there. They kind of make it so it feels like you're drinking some just a refreshing root beer. But then you see like, oh, it's alcoholic and quite heavily alcoholic drink.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. For me, out of all the places I've been in the world, I have to say that's probably my number one for alcohol. And then Ireland would be a close second. And it's like I always say this, so I'm sorry, you know, bloody broken record, but it's with beer, it's all to do with the water. It's that old saying. I believe it's an Irish saying, true. Actually, it's in the water, and Irish water is fantastic. So the alcohol, yeah, is really good. Like I remember having a Budweiser with the Irish water, and Budweiser's, you know, an American beer, but it tasted fantastic. Mm-hmm. And anytime I'd had it on draft in like London, it was disgusting. But in Ireland, it was fantastic. But yeah, yeah, in Prague, I don't know, like everything just felt like it had more good quality ingredients. Like I remember this one beer I had where it had the kind of consistency and texture of a Guinness, but it was much lighter. It was like a light version of Guinness. Mm-hmm. But it was wonderful. We had like a couple of those and I was drinking them slowly, but I was really enjoying it because it was really creamy and just relaxing and just chill. Like I was like, this is how a beer should be, you know? Yes. And like we have beers like that in England, but it's different. Like it's in different categories. So like our version of that would be ale. England is very well known for dark ales and different forms of ales, IPAs, that stuff.
Oh no, yeah, really good for at. Sure.
100%, like fantastic, really good stuff. But then when it comes to lagers, not so much. Everything that we've got is like European imported, and it's the same thing I was talking about before, where you get the mix from the other country, but then you mix it with the English water, and depending on mm-hmm. where you are in the country will affect it. So if you're in London, it's not going to taste great. If you're in somewhere like, oh, I don't know, Devon or somewhere like that, then it might actually taste all right. But it's a real kind of hit and miss because it's mixing the water with of that particular region with the solution and then hoping for the best. but like some beers,
good choice.
Yeah, but some beers are just bad. Like if you're drinking like a Carling, or Carling is Carling, it's just not good. Like it doesn't matter what you put possibly. In it. Like, you know what I mean? But then other beers, I don't know. I'm quite partial to things like Heineken, sometimes Stella Artois if it's got like good water. Like I said, you know, it depends. It really depends.
Nah, after I visited Prague, I couldn't stay the local beers or not so local beers just imported. They're like, no, it's not that. It's not the same. It's not the same feeling. That's how I almost stopped getting any kind of beers. Ales, on the other hand, that's a different story. Ales are.
Wait, you didn't like the local beers in Prague, or did I misunderstand?
No, I local beers in Russia.
Oh yeah, no. I
adored local beers in Prague, so I just like. Yeah, I kind of drink anything that doesn't taste like that and doesn't taste like that. And the people telling me, no, that's a beer, that's a lager. Just go and try it. Like, no, it's not.
No,
it's
you're
not how it's supposed to taste.
You're so right. I totally agree. It's exactly the same for me here in England. Like every now and again, I'll try a local beer just in case. But it's all down to the water. If the water's bad in the region, the beer, it doesn't matter what you do to it. It will still taste disgusting. So
yep,
it's a real hit and miss with that. But I don't know, like sometimes they can taste all right. Maybe it's the occasion, do you know what I mean? Sometimes like I'll just sit there and have like a Foster's in a pub garden on a sunny day, and that just feels like bliss. But then I wonder, is it more about the experience than the beer? Maybe I'm forgetting that the beer is bad and I'm just enjoying the day, you know? It's like,
yeah, just living the life at the moment.
Yeah. Oh, anyway.
At some point, I started discovering how many types of ale you actually produce in the United Kingdom. And that was a huge number. I was like, wow. I wanted to taste that, I will have to live there for a while.
That's the thing. Like, I'm surprised we don't push that more as a country. Like, when I discovered how many good ales that we have here in this country. I was blown away. I was like, wow, this is amazing. Why are we not like making more of a big deal of this? Like, this is fantastic. And there's other things as well, not just that. Like, if you go to certain parts of the country, like I'll use Devon as an example because I've been there before. Yeah. I remember trying things like a fudge, handmade fudge, and like handmade ice cream. And it was amazing. It's still to this day the best fudge or ice cream I've had anywhere in the world. And I always put it down to, well, maybe local ingredients, but also just the fact that it's homemade and it's done with care. And do you know what I mean? Like anything that's mass manufactured can never, you know, it can never compare to just, you know, stuff that's made handmade in a particular region. I don't know. There's just something about handmade.
Yeah. Better. They kind of try to unify the process of making the thing. Mm. And while the process of making the thing that has to allow some sort of chaos during the thing you produce.
Right. Yeah.
And you can't have those in a big factory.
Yeah, that, it's always sad, isn't it? When things get mass manufactured, like it's rare that it all continue to be as amazing as it was. I mean, I suppose you can do it. You can do it if it's still handmade, I think. If you just have a mass handmade situation, then that can kind of work. But then it makes your product very limited. Do you know what I mean? But then, I don't know, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe
and very expensive.
Yeah, maybe that's a good thing though, you know, like they often say, don't they, that, you know, that the finer things in life typically are worth the money. Like not everything, some things are just overpriced, but a lot of things, like good quality alcohol is, you know, bring it back, like that's a perfect example of that. Like I'm fully happy to pay over the odds for a fantastic cask whiskey from Scotland because I know that it's good quality.
Oh yeah.
But then when I go to like a local bar and I see an overpriced whiskey there and I know it's just another chemical tasting thing and the only thing I'm paying for is the brand, I get annoyed, I get insulted that that's the price is that high. I'm like this is not good, like you can't sell me on this is terrible. Do better.
Well, they still try.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's just sales, but you know.
Like, well, you're gonna try it, and like, but I know it's gonna taste it. But you're gonna try it. You cannot say that before you try it. Like, okay, let me try it. Okay, that's the. But I sold you one. Like you son of a gun.
Yeah, see, in that scenario, I would be like, give me a free sample. Best way.
Of course.
Yeah, if they really want to sell it to me and they're serious, give me a free sample. Give me a free shot. Let me taste the goods before you try and palm them off on me. That's the best way to make sales. You know, I used to work as a bartender for about a year and I would often do that. If people were unsure and they didn't know, I would just get like half shots, about two or three of them from each of the different alcohols, and I'd just pour a little bit and I'd be like, try some. And here's the thing, the reason that works, because people, like tight business owners would be like, oh no, what are you doing? You can't give away free alcohol. But what they're forgetting is like how much we charge per shot. It's ridiculous. Like sometimes you'll charge.
That's true.
It was a 4-star restaurant, hotel, bar, whatever. So we were charging like often £10 or more for one shot, right? So that's the thing. I know I can get a lot of money from these people. Like one time we did that. We had a group of businessmen in there and I did that. I gave them some free samples. They were like, okay, we want this one. I think it was called Lagavulin. It's like a Dutch whiskey or something like that. And, you know, a whole bottle is like, I think it's like £100, £80, something like that. But since we're charging per shot, you know, you get a hell of a lot more from it. So we made like, within, I would say, an hour, we made like £300 from them. You know what I mean? It's just...
Wow.
But that's the thing. Like the thing about that is that we haven't conned them. Do you know what I mean? I was fair. I gave them a shot. They were like, this is good. And they bought it of their own accord. They just kept ordering it. You know what I mean? So I didn't have to do anything else. Like I let the alcohol speak for itself. And that's how you sell an alcohol. You don't try and con people, be like, buy this, you'll love it. And then they hate it. And they're like, well, at least you bought it. And it's like, screw you, dude. Like, come on. Yeah, you got
kind of reminds me that same situation kind of reminds me of the current situation with video games. That's just my pet peeve. I'm just going to explain that. You know, everybody is crazy about trailers right now. Trailers and pre-orders. Mm-hmm. Like, check out our graphics. You know, like, you remember good old days when you just handed out demos of your game? Like, try this one level. Try this one chapter. Try this some of the game. Just a slice of the game.
But if to be like fair, they do still offer those sometimes, though. Like, that does
sometimes. Sometimes. And you can definitely say that quite a lot of them don't. Like any other Assassin's Creed, well, I mean, I understand why Assassin's Creed doesn't do demos, because what else are you going to sell there? It's the same Assassin's Creed, just with different characters.
Yeah.
Or something like that. But seriously, the free samples can sell quite a lot of stuff.
Yeah, the freemium
model. It's not just alcohol, it can sell a lot of stuff.
The freemium model in general is excellent. Like, I mean, I think with the whole demo game concept, just give the first level of a game. Do you know what I mean? And let it speak for itself. I think that's excellent. That leaves people wanting for more. Like, I've had that. I've played demos back in the 2000s, and I was like, oh my God, I need this game. And I would go and buy it. As soon as I had some money, I'd go and buy it. So it was an excellent tool for that. But I think in general, the thing that annoys me more about modern games these days is how you buy the base game, but then you have to spend a ton of money on all the extras. And like, don't get me wrong, DLCs and extras, okay, yeah, you should pay for them. It's a fair model for the most part. But like, when the game, let's say like you buy the game and it says you get access to this, 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 and this, and this, right? But then you discover later on, oh no, you have to pay for all of that. That I don't think is fair. Like, if you have a game and that's the game, and then the DLC is what it is. It's extra levels, it's extra characters. Okay, fine. That's clear as day. But don't promise me, you know, A to Z, and then say, oh no, you get like A to F, and everything else you have to pay for. And it's like, well, no, you weren't transparent with that. That's unfair. Like, you should be transparent in this stuff. Like, people are still gonna buy it.
That's true.
But just don't screw people over with it. And the thing is, there's so much choice in the video game industry now, and there's so many gamers that you're just shooting yourself in the foot if you do something like that.
But the saddest part, some companies really do get off with it. Like, take Electronic Arts, the infamous one.
Yeah.
They have the monopoly on mostly every sports game ever. I think they don't have monopoly for NBA, but it's like, well, your kid likes FIFA, tough luck, you're gonna pay us.
Yeah, that's
your kid loves FIFA Steel, tough luck, we're releasing the new game and where you have to pay even more.
See, I got mixed feelings about this as well, because the morality side of me says they shouldn't do that. It's, you know, it's horrible. Like, no one should monopolize the market. They should be fair to their customers, right? But the business side of me says, look, they're the only people in the market, really. I mean, yeah, you got the people doing, was it Pro Evolution Soccer or whatever it is. But it doesn't compare to FIFA and all the other titles they've got under their belt. And like, people are still going to buy it. It doesn't matter what happened. It doesn't matter if people feel like it's unfair. They're still going to buy the games. And EA knows that. And the only reason I think that EA has really changed things in recent years is just because of bad press. Because bad press can affect you. Like I said before, they'll still get people buying their games even though they've got bad press. Sometimes bad press actually brings you more sales, ironically. But like, I think for them, they're thinking long term. They're thinking, okay, we can do this for a certain amount of time, but then we have to change our image and actually give, you know, be fairer about this. And like, probably later down the line, they'll just do it again. And then it's probably just a PR tactic. They'll probably just like do it every couple of years to make themselves seem like the good guys, then the bad guys, then the good guys, because they know it will bring them more revenue. And that's what they're always thinking about. It's not about what's fair. It's about what brings us more revenue.
Hey, that's for sure. That's definitely what they're thinking first and foremost. Otherwise, they wouldn't have just decided to spew out FIFA every year and say, I don't know, oh, remember that famous football player you bought last year? You cannot transfer it, buy him again. And the next year, you're going to buy him again. You're like, why?
That's unfair. I mean, like, I got to say, sometimes for certain games, I don't know why they don't just kind of like, have everything transferable and then... Like, okay, here's a good example of what I mean. So like, if you take the WWE 2K games, right? I understand that they, yeah, I know they've fallen off the deep end with that latest episode, latest game. But if you just take the model as it is, like, as I understand, with every game, there's like exclusives and they only have a license on those people for so long, right? But it's like,
yeah,
this is a $1 billion company, right? If they wanted, they could afford to do some sort of thing where you could sort of play as anyone. And like, there's so many things that I'm surprised they don't know. Like, for example, right, it is possible to create characters in the game from you know, like, what is it, create a wrestler, and you can create, you know, wrestlers that don't actually wrestle for that company, right? And that's cool, and that's always been in the games even before 2K. But I don't understand why they don't just create, like, don't promote them, but create wrestlers from other organizations that you can play as unlockable characters in the game and just make money off that. Maybe they would have to like do some sort of deal with other companies, but they could do it and they can make a lot of money from doing that.
Yeah, they could.
And
yeah, probably, like, they will be lambasted again by a lot of fans because, oh no, I have to buy them separately. Why?
Well, I think that's fair. I think if you buy the base game,
I don't know,
and you want unlockable play like characters as extras, I think you should, like, yeah, because the thing is, that's how you extend the life of the game. Like, I think the problem with the 2K series is that there's a game out every single year, and I don't think they necessarily need to have a game out every single year. They could just update an existing game. Like, I don't know, it's weird. It kind of works and it doesn't work at the same time, if you know what I mean. Because the trouble with 2K as well is that, like, and this is the same with like pretty much any football game if you ever play. Yeah. I mean, football games have gotten better now because you can download the latest updates, so you can actually have teams that you know are accurate to that time. Whereas back in the day, you would always have the season prior because there's no other way you could do it. By the time the game is released, everything's different. It's just how transfer windows work. And the same is kind of true of wrestling. Like, if a wrestling game comes out on that particular time, you're getting storylines from like 6 months prior, 8 months prior. So like, some wrestlers won't even look the same anymore. But obviously, the way you get around that is downloadable updates, where, you know, you get accurate versions of the characters as they exist today. You know, it is possible.
They could also, I don't know if it's licensing, but let's call it licensing. They could try and license the way certain characters, especially in wrestling, looked at some time of their career.
I mean,
at some point of time, Steve Austin was just amazing, I think.
He's not that amazing
anymore, but including him right now, I would kind of better pay for Steve Austin from his hate of the career.
I mean, they do this. They do have versions of character. But the thing is, they don't... Here's something that frustrates me about those games. It's like, they'll do that. They'll offer like three versions of Kane, three versions of The Undertaker, but they won't give you like the option to get all of them. They'll only have specific ones. So like, what if you don't like any of those versions? Like, what if I don't like...
Yeah.
Taker 01, Taker 99, Taker 97. What if I want, I don't know, 2007 Taker? Why can't I have that? Like, you know what I mean? It's frustrating because they can do it. It's not that difficult to change the skins of the characters and make that possible.
Especially considering you don't have to move anything with the signature moves. You don't have to move anything with the finishers. Everything is going to stay the same.
Yep. I think
that's the gold mine.
it could be to do with licensing and stuff. Like, I know that's why wrestlers don't appear from game to game. But here's the thing: if a wrestler appeared in a previous game, why can't you transfer them to the next one and play as them? Do you know what I mean? Like,
that's because they're lazy.
Yeah, I don't get it. Because then you could have all the fantasy matchups you want rather than having to do create a wrestlers and having like a crappy version of the character.
No, it's actually a lazy programming. I think that's a lazy program. Like, I'm 80% sure that's a lazy programming when They have their engine, they have their roster, they have their everything. And every time they start the next year WWE, they start from scratch. They do not take the code they had. They start from scratch, really. They have the same engine, but they start from scratch doing everything again.
That seems pointless and, to me.
That's cheaper at some point, because the most expensive bugs you get to fix, those are bugs from the legacy code.
Okay.
But if you start every time from scratch, you kind of have like 2 months tops to make the game playable, and everything else is just polishing, polishing, polishing. And of course, when you polish, it is more expensive to polish it so it will work next year and next year after that. No, it's easier to fix it with some kind of half-baked patch,
yeah,
and call it a day. But next year, you cannot reuse this code.
That's interesting.
And I suppose every time they do that, they kind of shoot themselves in the foot, because they do not, they cannot allow you to transfer your player. It's going to be a very different player now. They don't use the same code. They don't use the same model. They reworked everything.
So are you, do you have much involvement or knowledge of games development? You sound like you know a little bit about that area.
Yeah, I worked for some time with a game development company here.
Oh, cool. Tell us more about that.
I had, it was a little fun time. I don't know if you ever heard about that. There was a project, let's call it a pet project of some one person who decided, like, I want to have the something like the tall simulation of the aircrafts from the World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like Il-2 Sturmovik was for when it came out, but the guy wanted to make it multiplayer, to have dogfights, to have the squads, to have all kinds of modern stuff there. Eventually, they made a production. Eventually, they decided to go for Unity. And again, eventually, they acquired some sort of manager who said, you know what's hot? Just really hot right now? Battle Royale. Battle Royale genres are very hot. They're just going to be the thing for next several years. And then people who were developing that, they were like, should we scrap all the thing we do?
Okay.
Apparently they had to, and they decided to make the Battle Royale on aircrafts from World War II, which is nuts, really.
Sounds
because
pretty cool.
The investor wanted the simulation. The Battle Royale is inherently arcade mode, and kind of marry those two.
I think,
but in any case,
yeah, I mean,
it didn't go well.
Okay, why not?
It kind of ended.
Why is that?
But you can still play the demo, kind of demo. It's more of a MVP version of the Battle Royale. It's, I suppose, it was still available on Android if nobody took it down.
Why didn't it work out, though?
Because they didn't even release it. Because after the Battle Royale became a thing and everything started working for, like, okay, this is Battle Royale, we can work this out, this is how it works, investors said, like, yeah, kind of, sort of, I like that, but let it be. He wasn't very sure about if he likes it or not likes
See,
it. But
this is why you need to do your research as a businessman. I can't believe,
yes.
I don't understand that. If someone is telling you, hey, this is really popular right now, like, to me, I would hear, ooh, chance to make a lot of money because a lot of people are doing this right now. I'm going to do my research, get some, or either myself or get like a statistician to do it for me, get some data, pull up some graphs, find out how much money this could potentially make me. Why would you, and also, why would you pump your money into a project and then be like, nah, let's just leave it? Like, what? I get your return.
I don't know. I think
least.
It was just a passion project, and the guy wanted to have his own version of the game, but then somebody said, like, oh, we have a business opportunity there. And he's like, but that's my passion project.
Oh, that's different.
But then again, I have to feed all the people in this company. Well, let's go for the business side, not for the passion side. And it ended up, if I remember correctly, it ended up War Thunder made its own Battle Royale rules. They already have the engine. They already have the airplanes. They have even the airplanes that could not ever fly.
Mm.
And the business opportunity just ended there. Just who are you going to sell that? Like, hi, we're an indie game. It's like that one game that is free, but we have a requirement for us to pay money. Yeah. Sorry. So, no, it didn't work well. And after that, I had several other involvements. Well, mostly because I had very many chats with friends who are still in this game development business.
Oh, cool.
Well, I just stopped being there because, you know, being tester in game development kills all the fun.
So you've been a games tester as well?
Yeah.
All right, talk to us about that, because I've never met a games tester before.
The most fun job until you start doing it. Imagine the job description. Oh, we have the game and the game have bugs and you have to report those bugs. And how do you report? Of course, you try and play the game. It's like, wow, 8 hours a day. You play a game, then you report the bugs you found. Wow. That's amazing. I'm going to do that. But they just neglect to mention that 8 hours the game, 8 hours a day, you just do not play the game. You play the game properly. And which means that if somebody found a bug, or if you found a bug, that if you land in a certain spot on the map, some part of the map just disappears and you can see it if you turn camera correctly. It doesn't mean like, yep, I found it. Go fix. No, it means that it might have the consequences. This bug might be not just on the airport. It might be anywhere else you can land. And you're like, okay, let's try and land everywhere. And you just go around landing everywhere. You're not having fun. You're just landing everywhere, turning the camera, looking at everything. At any given moment, if anybody asks you, well, do you have fun doing that? You're like, what is fun? Where do we have a fun in our game?
Well, okay. Playing devil's advocate for a second. Like, yeah, is it a well-paid job? You know, I mean,
No, it's not well-paid. It's the entry level for the game development. Game development itself has quite a lot of volunteering persons. Like, every person from high school, they want to become in game development somebody. And the most entry position is game tester. After that, you can go to the QA, but it's still entry position.
Mm.
If you are going into the code checking, into kind of system integration testing in your game, until then, which requires the proper education, until then, everything considered an entry position.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, what's the difference between being a games tester and then being a QA? So that's a quality assurance, isn't it?
Yeah, during the game test, you kind of have extra duty while having less duty at all. When you are QA, you kind of have to report every bug that looks like a bug. Being a game tester, you don't have to report every bug ever. It's not your actual job. Your actual job is to figure out how people play the game, give reports on how you play the game, how it's more convenient to play the game. Is it even fun to play the game? What do you want during the gameplay?
That's a very subjective question, though. I mean, have fun? I mean, well, people find fun in different things. I mean, for example, GTA 3 when it first came out, or even just games like that. I personally, I loved it, but like, I think the more fun element to it is not actually the story. It's always the capabilities. How much chaos can I cause? How much craziness can I cause? That's the exactly. more fun element of the game, really.
And that should not break the game. If something happens, it usually happens just because nobody planned for it. You know, when even if in those GTA games, they started as vastly different games. But somebody said, hey, I'm having too much fun wreaking havoc along this city, along this ride. And they're, you know what? We can do that. We should do that. And that's how GTA 1 appeared, if the legends to be believed.
Mm.
They started as the very different game. I think it was like more like a story about some kind of cop-related story, like detective that wanted to infiltrate the mafia, yada, yada, yada. But no, they're like, you know what's fun? Fun is to destroy everything, to see cars blow up. And they released it, and it was a hit. And now we have GTA 5, where everything is about destroying everything and bringing more chaos with you.
What do you think about the fact that like they haven't released a new version of a new installment of Grand Theft Auto since 2013, and they keep re-releasing the same game?
They already have three consoles.
It's pretty crazy, isn't it? Like I understand, like from the business side of things, they're making just a ton of money from GTA Online and all the DLCs and stuff like that. So I do understand to some extent, but what do you make of that? Like, what's your opinion on that?
And my opinion on that is just they're comfortable with that. They don't want to release anything else because there's less risk from the business standpoint, less risk from the game publisher standpoint, and less risk from just rolling the whole different product on the market standpoint. Because, you know, when you release the game, you may or may not like it. When you release the GTA 5 on the next generation of consoles, you know there will be people liking it. There are already people liking it. You have no risk.
I'm surprised that people still play like play it, though. Like, I understand it's because of the GTA Online, but like,
yeah,
really? Can it really have been that good for like 8 years straight? I think it's 8 years. Yeah, 8 years going. Like, surely, eventually, it's got to kind of give, and you just get bored of it. Like, I was surprised after the first couple of years after the game, because typically with these releases, you know, you've got like maybe a, let's say a 3 to 5 year window, maybe a little bit less. And then eventually you need to release a new game. And there's always people talking like, oh, we need GTA 6. We need GTA 6. And I think
they don't really need GTA 6.
I think we do now. I mean, eventually you need to give people something new to work with. Do you know what I mean? Like, you need, because
actually people would have been quite fine if they just decided to go with a GTA 5 engine and just a different story, different city, different everything.
Yeah, but okay, straight away, different city. So new game then. Extend, like, I get what you're saying, like you extend,
but with the same engine content.
Yeah, but I mean, look, I don't have any qualms about the engine, whatever, like you can do, you know, more content with the same engine, it doesn't really change anything.
That's true.
I'm just talking about like because when you release a new game, it's not just about the new content, it's about things like fixing the issues you had with the previous engine and you know, and also giving people something else to work with. Like, a lot of people say that the new, that GTA 6 should be a revisit to Vice City, and I think that that would be interesting. I think it would be fun in HD, but I actually think that it would be more interesting if they went in a different direction and maybe did like the 70s, something like that.
Oh, that's true.
Something
they
they've
tried
not done
to do
before.
That in GTA 1 London expansion.
Yeah, but they, come on, dude. It's look, I'll be honest, controversial.
They
but
should
I don't,
go back to London.
I don't. Well, yeah, that would be amazing. But I don't think they'll ever do that. I don't think there's enough of a market there for that. As sad as it sounds, I think people wouldn't be as interested in a GTA London HD game. And they've kind of already done that with like Watch Dogs, haven't they, or whatever it is? Because I think there's a version of it that's based in the UK.
Yeah, the latest installment.
Right.
It's kind of Watch Dogs is a miss after miss after miss. I have no idea. I mean, I understand that there are people who are interested in this, in these kind of games.
Mm.
Like when you're a hacker and everybody is just your playground and you're such a serious hacker, I mean, with the first game, they were going for hackers from the movie Hackers. They were going for that feel. Like, these are people in trench coats. They have everything to hide. They're dangerous. The cyber police is upon them and stuff like that. You know, the goofy thing that just they were taking it too seriously. And it's fine. I'm completely fine with that. But they did not add enough goofiness. I mean, even the movie Hackers had their own moments of goofiness, but no, Watch Dogs 1 had none. Then they decided to go like 180, and the next Watch Dogs, the second part, was about the hipster who is kind of sort of hacker, but not really. He is most of a like a hip person who likes to take selfies, pilot his drone, and have a, I don't know, time of his life, I guess. Yeah, because I mean, I have seriously, I have troubles to understand what this guy is doing for life.
They probably just did more research, do you know what I mean? So it sounds like the first installment, they just didn't do as much research and kind of just
went with a generic approach. They overdid it again. They overdid it. It was not fun again. It was, again, too serious. It's like serious hipster guy.
I think that's subjective. And then, like, everyone has a different idea of what they enjoy in a game.
That's a possibility. Stuff, yeah. But I can take in my defense one thing. In the third installment, the Legion one, they went back to, oh, we're serious. We're working against the system. We're not the hipster guys. We're very serious there. The one that is set up in London.
Yeah. So, I mean,
I would consider that as, yeah, they didn't add enough something.
I would like to see a game set in London or the UK. I think the UK has a lot of cool areas that would really work for like a Grand Theft Auto style game. I think the last game that really did it well in recent memory is probably The Getaway, and that's an old game back in we're talking like 2000 early 2000s. But the best thing about it was it was you know, accurate to the time, and it was set in London, and many of the maps looked, you know, it was accurate to like modern London. It was really cool. It was just a shame you could do more with it and there wasn't more interactivity. It wasn't quite like, it was open world and it wasn't, like, you still had to sort of operate within the context of the storyline, but so there wasn't much interactivity as far as, I don't know, going into shops, doing activities, that sort of thing. So that would be cool to see in a modern game. But again, do you know what? I think the reason they don't do it is because there isn't as much relatability. I think American culture seems to have more of a worldwide appeal and people seem to be more familiar with it internationally. Whereas British culture, maybe it's still, like, people love Britain, but maybe it's still not quite as universally appealing as US. That's my theory. I could be really wrong on that, but I reckon that's why they don't do it. Because it is a gamble.
I would actually agree with you on that theory. I had to learn quite a lot of modern British attitude, more modern British traditions, just again about modern Britain, because everything we learned was I think from the time when I don't know, maybe from the Soviet Union even.
Wow.
That was like very a long time ago.
Let's move things forward. What do you do for a living? What's your job?
I write code that tests other code.
Ooh. So a code programmer, coder, what's the
official? It's kind of like automation QA tester of, I don't know, kind of a person who just writes the code that runs and shows other people that their code might not work as it was intended to.
Okay. So kind of like you're the guy that people come to, when they want to kind of check for mistakes, check if check if something works properly, I guess, like a tester. Yeah, code tester, yeah, as you said. Yeah,
like a code tester, right. Or rather just a regular tester, because sometimes people can ask, like, check out this code in the language I am not familiar with. And I just like, what does it have to do? What does it have to do out? It's like, okay, then I write the test cases, then I execute tests, and they're like, you know, that time you said that if you pass this data into your code, you get this. You know what? You don't get anything. Like, oh, nice, thanks.
So what are the best and worst things about being a coder?
Best thing is when your code works.
Well, naturally.
Of course. Just imagine you wrote a bunch of code. You did not test this code. You just wrote it and you run it and just works. Like, okay, oh, that's the best feeling in the world.
I get what you mean.
That's the best thing about it. The worst thing is just it gets... you do a lot of tedious work. It could get boring really quickly. Mm-hmm. Because most of the times you just reuse your old code.
So it's just repetitiveness.
Yeah, it's very repetitive. And even if you don't reuse your own code, you're just writing the same old code, but with just a different, maybe different parameters, maybe different outcome, maybe something else different. But for most of the time, it's just very repetitive. But so, it's fine.
So you're also a Twitch streamer.
Yes.
So tell us about this Quack Pack streamer team that you're a member of. What exactly is that?
That was a funny finding. I was discovered by a person who goes by Twitch handle Duck Plague. I go by Mr. Angry Ducky and he's Duck Plague. So
you kind of get this fascination with ducks. Like, what's the deal?
Yeah, but you kind of get the idea. Like, we both are fascinated with ducks.
Why?
we all have our own reasons. I don't know. I just like ducks. I do associate myself with a duck.
How? Well, how do you associate yourself with a duck?
It happened at some point way back in my life. When, you know, the kids in their early days, they have some fascination with animals and so on. Okay. So my daughter at some point decided to name everybody an animal.
Okay.
I became a duck. Okay. And since that point, I decided, like, well, you know how they say, if it was said by a child, it might be true. I will go on with a duck.
Fair enough. If it works, it works, I guess.
Mostly because I think it was mostly because we had a huge collection of rubber ducks. Just because we had a huge collection of rubber ducks. Nothing personal, really. It became personal after that.
I just love ducks. Ducks good.
Yeah, you cannot not love ducks.
It's true. Ducks are cool. Yeah, so like with your Twitch streaming, what exactly is this? Sort of, I interrupted you before. What exactly does the Quack Pack streamer sort of team do? Like,
oh, it's just a regular streamer team that was centered around ducks. Initiator of the stream team, as I told you already, was Duck Plague. Okay. He's actually partnered on Twitch. Oh, and cool. He's an artist, and sometimes he streams his art while he's drawing some things, and sometimes he streams games being played. He's from Sweden, actually.
Cool.
Which is fun. But when he found me, I was like, dude, you're seriously in a Quack Pack? How am I not in a Quack Pack? And he's like, I don't know. Why are you not in a Quack Pack yet?
Okay. It's like, we just had I like ducks. Do you like ducks?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, then let's love ducks together.
They're like, let's be friends. Because we both love ducks.
Let's share our love of ducks.
Also, ducks are tasty.
Well, I won't disagree.
You have to consider that too.
Oh, this just makes me want duck now. I haven't had duck in years. Duck is good.
I've had one fairly recently, like a month ago. So good.
How could you? You say you love ducks and you eat them. What's wrong with you?
They're tasty. I'll have them in any form. Even a roasted duck.
Not roasted? How could you?
Though with a huge appetite.
So you also play retro games such as Need for Speed Most Wanted, one of my favorite games, and then new games like Cyberpunk 2077. So tell us about your Twitch streaming, your likes, dislikes, and which you prefer, old or new games.
Oh, that's a tough question. mostly because I prefer games with a really good story. As you mentioned, or you didn't mention, all of those things I play on streams, they are mostly single player. I kind of tried to stream multiplayer games, but they're not for me. I kind of, during the Twitch streams, I found out that I have trust issues. When somebody comes over on stream to me while I'm playing multiplayer games, and like, hi, I saw your stream. How about I give you something? Like, okay, I don't trust you, dude. Can I block you, please?
That's the thing I found out. Why don't you trust them?
I don't know. Just I don't trust people. First thing I consider that he's gonna play an epic prank on me, and then they just share the resources. Like, what is wrong with you? Why didn't you play epic prank on me? I was ready to accept something.
You're being nice. People aren't nice. Exactly, what are you doing?
Like, what kind of sorcery is that? Why are you nice? What is wrong with this world? So, you know, living in Eastern Europe, when people come over to you and being nice and like, what is wrong with you?
Just assume.
What do you want? What do you want from me? But then again, everything else, single player games with great stories. Okay, not great stories. If we're talking about Most Wanted with great gameplay and at least some story. It at least has some story. Need for Speed Most Wanted from 2012, it didn't have any story at all. They re-released it.
Oh, okay.
And they re-released it to iPad, consoles, every console ever. The PC, they released it everywhere. And they just decided to name it Most Wanted.
Hmm.
Not even Most Wanted 2. And the whole premise of the game was... there is a most wanted list. Go to the top place. Cool.
That's boring.
That's it.
What made the original game so fun was the chases with the police and how much money you could rack up in terms of being the most wanted. It was like, how much carnage can I cause? It was an amazing game.
And what kept you going in the first place when you just started this game was the fact that you didn't like the police. You didn't have... any good feelings towards the police, because a first encounter with the police was finished like that one policeman actor taking out the key and scratching your car
long.
You're like, oh, I hate you now. Every policeman is my enemy.
I don't normally like racing games, if I'm honest. I'm not a big fan, but like the way that story was done was just really intelligent and it made sense.
Yes.
And it was like, it still functions perfectly as a standard racing game, but it kind of raises the stakes and makes it much harder and much more enjoyable as a result, I think.
Yeah. And then it just takes away everything in the end when you learn that Razor, the most dangerous boy in the hood, his name is Clarence. It kind of destroys all the character of that big dangerous guy. No, not a single dangerous guy is called Clarence. How many guys called Clarence you know who are living a secret life of a street racer or just having any kind of trouble with the police?
Yeah, but to be fair, like I even if I did have a double life, I'm not gonna Do you know what I mean? I'm going to call myself something cool, something fearful.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to call myself like Buttercup or something. Like...
Oh, but that would be the first mistake. A rookie mistake, because who's going to be scared of the Buttercup? They're not going to give.
Yeah, but that's 100%. My point. That's my point. Is like I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give myself some fearful name. So even if my original name is like something silly, or like
I would, you know I mean? Would call myself a Buttercup. I would call myself a Sweetheart, because I'm going to win this.
Puppy. Just call yourself like puppy and kittens, puppy kitten or something.
Yes, Fluffy Duckling. There we
Fluffy Duckling, yeah.
That's the perfect name.
He's the most feared man in Europe. And he goes by the name Fluffy Duckling.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, exactly. How cool would that be?
That would actually be quite like, funny.
Yeah, but everybody can be scary when they're called Razor or Mike the Murderer. But try to be scary when you're called the Fluffy Duckling. That's an achievement.
The cute kin.
Yeah.
Fluffy puppy.
Yeah, and the fun part is that sometimes you can get the good story in the games only if you go retro or just indie games. Most of the time when you open up some kind of modern next big thing, there's going to be some story, but it's not going to be some epic story. It's not going to be some story that just clicks together. And you want to find the better stories, the stories that will challenge you, the stories that will tell you something new, the stories that will tell you something interesting. And you kind of have limited options there. You either go Witcher 3 or you go search for some kind of older games. It's like, I don't know if you heard ever, there is a game called Anachronox.
No.
It was developed by Tom Hall, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was Tom Hall.
What's it about?
That's like a Western take at the JRPG genre.
Okay.
Like Japanese RPGs, they're famous for sometimes like standing in the line while attacking each other. And who falls first loses. You know those Final Fantasy rules. You just stay in the line. Enemy attacks, you take hit. You attack, enemy takes hit, and whoever dies loses.
Okay.
And that was the attempt to make a JRPG, kind of a JRPG, but in the Western style. And it was a good idea. It was done very tastefully. The only problem there is that. For your first playthrough, you will require the wiki for several times. Well, most of the times because it was not designed to be casually played because it's like, oh, I'm not giving 100% for this game. It's not serious. It's silly. Mm. But yeah, it is silly. The fun fact, it is silly. It never takes itself too serious. At some point of this game, you rescue the whole planet. And the planet decides to join you. People on the planet voted to join you, to join your party.
That's cool.
And you have a planet, size of a human being, just a planet. Fun.
Let's move it forward. So you're the host of the Duckin' Games podcast, a podcast about video games. Why did you choose to start this podcast, and what sort of topics do you tend to discuss on the show?
Well, I started this podcast because I wanted to tell people about video games. I kind of saw a lot of shows that were about contemporary scandals in video game industry, like, oh, you heard those guys, they effed up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but what about their game? Is the game any good? okay, they effed up in the PR department, but is the game good? Because sometimes you can have fun with the bad games. Sometimes you can be bored by really good games.
It's true.
And in the end of the day, it's just what experience you had with it. The main idea I'm trying to push there is some games are good, some games are bad, no matter what other people telling you, like, oh, but it was sold 10 million copies in the first week. Okay, but is it good? Okay, if it's good, you may not enjoy it. It's fine. It's all right. It's your experience. It's valid. If the game is bad, if the game is absolute trash and no redeeming factors, but you had a good experience with it, more power to you. It's also valid. And, just be aware that some games are good, some games are bad, and it loosely correlates with whether you like it or not.
And what have been some of the main challenges of doing this podcast, producing this podcast?
Doing the research. Sometimes you have to do research like how they decided to make the certain game, why they decided to make a certain game this way. And, you know, I firmly believe that every bad decision was made because of something. And they thought of something. They wanted to make something good, or at least they wanted to make money at the very least. But I tried to find out what led to that decision. And sadly, I have to admit, most time than not, because the podcast is not very big, not as big as I want it to be, not as big as Joe Rogan, I cannot contact most of the developers to ask them, why was this decision made? I have to search for interviews. I have to read the interviews. I have to watch them. I have to read some other people who ask them. And this is the part that takes most of the time. Mm-hmm. It's like I'm making episode. I'm recording the episode for like hour, edited in hour and a half, and another 16 hours goes into research.
That sounds good. I mean, it sounds similar to what I do. Like you got to set aside a time. Like I actually read someone's book that they sent me recently as preparation for their podcast, and I've never gone that far. Like normally I just do like research on the person, and it depends. Sometimes it's a bit quicker, sometimes it's longer. It depends on like the types of questions that spring to mind, but some are really obvious, some are less obvious. And the less information you have on someone, the trickier it really gets to interview them, which is why I rely so heavily on ad-libbing and the conversation itself. So it's like, hopefully it goes better than what you have on paper. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, I don't know.
Yes. You always hope that somebody is going to be more talkative than you're prepared to.
Yeah. You hope for that. But like you know, it's like sometimes I do research on people and I only fill half the page and I'm like, but this is all I have. Like, I've got nothing else to go on here. Like, what else can I ask them? So it's like, but it never seems to be a problem. I don't know. In my case, I've never noticed that. But I guess it's just luck at this point. But anyway, moving it forward, tell us more about your thoughts on interactive mediums and interactive media.
Oh, interactive medium is a broad term. At some point, interactive medium, you can say that, the video games are interactive medium. That's it. Then again, what about people just interacting with each other in VR chats?
Okay.
Those are technically not a games. They don't have gameplay. They don't have losing state. They don't have winning state. It's just environment. And it's interactive environment. And it's a medium. But then again, if you just tell in video games, what kind of video games you're referring to? Like there are most of the mainstream games that have win state, lose state, and then there are cookie clickers on Facebook and on mobile phones. Like, are those games? Can you lose after you go bankrupt? Technically, yes, you lose if you go bankrupt in real life, of course. You cannot afford any more microtransactions and you're losing.
Yeah.
Then again, how interactive cookie clicker is. If I write a simple Python script that clicks, the exact same place time and time again. I'm not interacting with anything. I'm just sitting there looking at the cookie being clicked. It's loosely interactive. But in any case, you kind of have to consider all of that if you talk about interactive media. But if you talk about video games, you can specify, like, we're talking about the computer games that are just for consoles, PCs, and that's it. Not touching mobile games. I try to not touch mobile games because one time I worked with a company that had the mindset of the publisher of the mobile games. And there was an ironically person who was defending Electronic Arts making a 24 hours countdown for some timer. I was like, what do you expect? You've got to pay for that. You're going to pay for that action. And I couldn't get my head around it. How is it supposed to be? It was Dungeon Keeper by Electronic Arts, the mobile game. If you want to dig one space of dirt, you're going to waste 24 hours.
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah.
And he was unironically happy with that decision. He was unironically applauding Electronic Arts and saying, like, what is wrong with it? I don't get it.
Well, okay.
They're making money.
Are you talking about this specific scenario where, like, you get like a certain amount of like energy within game, and then when you use it, if you want more energy, you either have to wait for 24 hours to get more, or you have to pay to get more energy? Is that kind of what you mean?
Not really. Electronic Arts made it obvious that you have your imp who is digging the wall 24 hours. But you can feed him something that can be bought only with real life money.
Right.
You can feed him, and then it takes about 5 minutes.
Okay, so similar, yeah. Like, you have to pay to get quicker more interaction, or you have to wait, basically. Yeah.
Kind of like that, yeah. But nevertheless...
Oh, I understand that the action actually takes 24
yes.
actual hours, not in-game
yes.
actual hours.
Actual 24 hours.
Oh, that's stupid. Yeah, that's ridiculous.
But he was happy with that. He was actually happy. He was applauding them and saying, this is great. This is best revenue collection I have ever seen. And I couldn't get my head around that mindset. Like, how distanced you have to be from your consumer base to consider this alienation a good decision.
I'm all about making money in business. Like, I've studied business many years, so I do understand that angle. But that is just, that's not logical, like, at all. Like, that's off-putting. To anyone playing the game, once they realize straight away it takes 24 hours to do anything, it's like, fuck that. Like, I'll go play a game where exactly. I've got more interactivity and I don't have to wait that long. Like, typically, like, you know, I'm not ashamed to say it. I've been, in the past, years ago, addicted to those, like, Facebook click games where it's like... or like Candy Crush Saga. Big one that I was into was, I can't remember what it was, Farmville, but there was a game similar to Farmville, some sort of like city builder type game. And I was so addicted to that.
Oh,
so addicted.
All right. Yeah. I was working on one of those too.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, with those, they were fair. So like certain things would legit take 24 hours, but other things would take like 2 hours or an hour or 30 minutes or less than that. So it was a game. It was clever in that you would keep coming back, you know, to check on the status of things and whatnot, but you could always make some sort of progress.
Exactly.
Like, the game gave you,
exactly.
like, if you just wanted to play it for free, it allowed for that, but it positioned the payment stuff as a way of like either speeding up the stuff or giving you exclusive access to certain things that you couldn't get otherwise. So it's like you're giving your customers you're throwing them a bone. You're being fair to them. Like, not everything has to be paid. Mm-hmm. And if anything, you're giving them more incentive to actually pay for things because you're giving them stuff for free. It's like that freemium model thing.
You give them a choice and they choose to pay you because they want to have more fun. It's not like you're sitting there holding the gameplay hostage and saying, pay me.
Exactly. That's basically what that guy is presenting. Like, he thinks, oh, it's a great money spinner. And it's like, yeah, but if you're only focused, if you're making a game and all you're focused on is making money, the game will fail. because you've missed the key point. Like the game has to be fun. It's like you said before, like it's all well and good making a game, but like you got to focus on actually making the game fun. Is this a fun game to play? Or is it just something that's designed by programmers? Because there's a big difference.
Or something designed by, even worse, CEO.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to give you a real serious question now. But I ask all of my guests this, and it always gets a unique response. What's the biggest life lesson that you've learned so far?
Man, I have learned so far so much. The biggest one, I think the biggest one, I would say that you have to not believe every person who says anything. Like at some point when people tell you, if you're doing good, your manager or your CEO will look at you. They will see, oh, this guy is good. I should give him a raise. Everybody tells you that when you're in school or when you're in college.
Yeah.
It never happens.
It's true.
If you're good at your work, you're going to get more work. Then somebody says, oh, if you did something, you should actually go and tell them. They will understand. They're people. They will understand. You will have to go extra mile for them to understand. So anything people tell you about the rules of how to interact with other people, it's all false.
I gotta
say, that's the biggest lesson.
I kind of half disagree. I think it depends with that. Like sometimes when you're interacting with certain people, certain things you get told growing up are true. But yeah, that example you gave is a perfect example. I was actually watching a YouTuber that I like earlier who was talking about this. And like I've only ever been given one pay rate. No, I've had a few pay rises, but the first ones I had, I didn't work for. Oh, I did, but like they were in like a supermarket, so they were like, you know, mini. They were nothing. We were still on minimum wage. Do you know what I mean? It was just to satiate us. It was like a little like, oh, that's nice, but it doesn't really help. But the actual first proper pay rise I got, I asked for, and it was bold. Like literally, I'd been working for them for like 8 months at this point, but my job had expanded into so much more. So I started as this, and I ended up doing this. And I said to them, like, I need to like basically leave and go somewhere else unless you can give me a pay rise and a promotion, because I'm just doing loads and not getting paid for it. And they agreed, and they actually gave me the promotion. But I think I was lucky, because I agree with you. I think that when you think about getting pay rises, the only way you really tend to get pay rises is by quitting your job and going somewhere that'll pay you more.
Because
there's a reason that company has not raised your wages and advertised the role at that amount. It's because their budget, you know what I mean? Like they're trying to make money. They're a business. So if they start giving people pay rises, they lose money, right? And it doesn't matter if they can afford it. It's about making as much money as possible, cutting as many costs. You know, I know people like to romanticize this idea of, oh, I work for a company and they care about me and it's a work family and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, they care about you.
It's BS.
They do care about you. They will have to pay their HR extra if you decide to quit.
Well, not really. I mean, from what I've heard, it doesn't affect them, because like the way what I've understood about work, especially corporate, is that like they can easily replace you. You're just a number.
Yes.
So,
but they will have to adjust their payment for the current position. The current position always, normally, always every year is indexed to become higher.
Yeah, but like that percentage you're talking about is tiny. It's like less than 1%. So like, okay, if it was 24K last year, maybe it's like 24.2 this year. It's nothing. It's peanuts. Like,
to be honest, here it's more of something.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right. Maybe it's different.
Here it's more like if it was 24K per year. Again, I'm not doing with the certain numbers. The next year it might as well be 25k. And they will have to adjust to that when they're searching for a new guy.
Yeah, but that's minimal. I mean, generally speaking, if they want to keep it like below the market average or you know, around the market average, they'll just do that. Like, because the thing is, if you leave and you're not happy, they don't care because they'll just find someone exactly. who will do it. Like most of the companies I've worked for, they're trying to lower it all the time. Like when you leave, they'll either get rid of the role and just work with less people. I've seen that a lot where they just don't replace people until they're desperate, or they will replace you, but they'll do it for like a third less than what they were paying you. You know what I mean?
That's weird.
It's very common. Yeah.
How is he even in business?
You know, this is in Europe as well. This isn't just the UK, it's Europe as well. I think it's just because they can get away with it, especially in Europe, because there's less stringent rules. So I think that's a big factor. I haven't seen it as much in the UK, if I'm honest. I've seen more, the stuff I've seen in the UK is more to do with like screwing people over with like internships and stuff like that. That's more the issue.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But in Europe, it seems to be that like when I lived in Estonia, for instance, like people would just get fired on the spot, like randomly. And I was stunned to see that, like how someone who's been working in the business for like 7 years can just get fired like that. I was amazed because you've just let someone go who's got 7 years experience and you don't care. That's pretty amazing. B, the fact that they can legally get away with that, it just blew my mind.
They can. Yeah. They're not doing anything against the law. They're just...
But that's the thing. In the UK,
managing the human
UK,
resources.
It's different. In the UK, firing someone is very difficult. You have to go through a whole process. This is what I mean. This is why a lot of companies, you'll see, especially in the UK, will do this thing where they'll all put you on probation, but the probation lasts a long time, like maybe anywhere between 3 to 6 months. And the key with that is that at the end of that, they can just get rid of you. Right. Or they can just sort of like justify firing you at the end of it and not having to worry about it and also paying you probably less because it's the probation period and stuff. Like there's ways they can get around it. Wow. So if they don't like you within 6 months, they can just fire you, and legally they're entitled to do that. But after the 6 months or the 3 months, firing you then becomes very difficult because then you have rights. So then, for instance, you've got like the standard system is like a verbal warning, written warning, final meeting and firing, you know, but like then it becomes very difficult to justify action against you. So it's interesting. I don't know.
To be honest, it's kind of hard here to fire a person. It's much easier to bully a person so they want to quit.
Yeah, that's I've seen that here in the UK as well. Like often what will happen is they'll give you an ultimatum, won't they? They'll be like, well, either you take voluntary redundancy or we fire you. Like that's normally how they put it to you.
Yeah, something like that. And they just bully you into saying, all right, I quit. This was my decision.
Yeah. So then they're legally protected. Ah, I don't know. It's bad. It's bad. But anyway.
people are fun.
As we draw things to a close for today, do you have any upcoming projects or maybe some final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Oh, that's a tough one. So far, I don't have any more projects than I already have. I kind of stated in my podcast that... I am trying to make some sort of my own game. It is not some kind of project that I'm working on from the morning till the night falls. No, it's when I have some spare time. I have a lot of things to learn, a lot of mistakes to not fall into, a lot of traps to not fall into. And while I'm doing it, I do researches with podcasting. Mm-hmm. I do the research in Duck and Games podcast. Every once in a while, I think it is every third week, I have an episode. Next one is going to be about Doom 3, I assume, because I have done a humongous ton of research about that, and I need to tell it to somebody. And of course, Twitch streaming, we have started today, we have started The Dusk, one of those games that are called Boomer Shooters.
Boomer Shooter, I've never heard of that before.
Oh, that's a very nice term. Like, you know, those shooters like the original Doom, when you didn't have to think about reloading the weapon, when the regular movement speed was faster than Usain Bolt. And
the sensitivity
when everything
was just fucked. Yeah.
Yeah, everything was just tuned to be more fun to you.
Yeah.
And The Dusk is one of those.
Cool.
It's mad fun. It's crazy fun. I absolutely loved it. I also follow the developer of Dusk, David Zemanski, on Twitter, and he gave me a blessing.
Oh, awesome. Awesome, man.
Just today.
Well, listen, best of luck with that, with your podcast and your Twitch Twitch stream. And yeah, just all the best to you. And you've been a wonderful guest. Thank you so much for appearing on the show.
And you too. Take care, and you have a nice show. Keep it that way.
I will, I will. To everyone listening to the Christian Reef podcast, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed it, if you're listening on YouTube, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe. Do not forget, it's important. And also let me know your thoughts. Let me know in the comments below, did you like it? Did you dislike it? Who would you like to see on the show next? What would you like to hear on the show next? If you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you listen to the Christian Reef podcast, leave us a review, leave us a like, a follow, whatever. Everything that you can do, please do. It's really appreciated. It really helps me to sort of grow this and move it forward and make sure that the Christian Reef podcast is as good as it possibly can get. Because as far as I'm concerned, the growth never ends. And it really will help if I have your support and your feedback. And to everyone still, you know, obviously supporting the podcast and listening to the podcast regularly, thank you so much. It means the world to me, and I'm really enjoying doing this. And yeah, all the best. I'll see you when I see you in the next one. Peace out, one love.